Well, it's one of those Sundays that has got an extra little bit to it that if you follow the Presbyterian Church in Canada's thing, it's Heritage Sunday, which was passed a long time ago, 10 years ago, I think, or something. The third Sunday in February is Heritage Sunday, and we can do as much or as little with that as we like, and as obviously it's the case, we're not doing a great deal with it. But it did get me thinking about this passage in Matthew. Because like the purpose of a heritage, or at least the purposes that we put it to, as much as anything, is to ground us in where we are now. A heritage, or our heritage, is part of what allows us to be sort of who we are at the moment. It's a foundation, if you will. People who don't have a heritage, or don't know where they came from, can sometimes be sort of at sea. And so it makes sense for us to pay attention to where we came from, where our ancestors came from, where our church came from, whatever it might be, because it gives us a sense of place. One of the things that I find most interesting is that as our societies become more and more fragmented, as people move and all those sorts of things in ways that they didn't 100 years ago or more, there's this incredible rise in an interest in our genealogies. Peggy's done a lot of work on hers and her family's. My brother did a bunch of work. My crazy Aunt Alice did even more work than that. Okay, that was a term of affection, although she was a little peculiar in some ways. But we didn't need that 100 years ago the same way we do now, because everybody knew exactly where they came from. It was right where they were, because people didn't move around as much. And a sense of place, a sense of history, a sense of heritage can be a really important thing for us. It gives us a sense of continuity with the past. It connects us to something larger. But it can go overboard. All the way from thinking that our own family is so much better than everyone else's, that everyone else's family is actually kind of useless, which is a caricature of most people's family pride, of course. But we can get so wrapped up in what's happened before that we kind of lose sight of what's happening now. And in a very real way, Jesus is addressing this kind of thinking in this passage in Matthew. And what Jesus is helping people realize, or at least trying to help them realize, is that the law wasn't enough. The law was something that got us to the next step. There's all kinds of ways for us to think of Old Testament law and its purposes, but part of it was creating a people who understood that there was something beyond themselves that had requirements upon them, that it wasn't just doing what you felt like at the moment. It wasn't just individual anarchy, which is what that comes down to. And by the time Jesus arose on the scene, or Jesus showed up on the scene, the law had been codified, had been strengthened, had been set in such a way that it was immovable. It had reached the point where everything needed to go through this grid of the law as interpreted by the people of the time. And sometimes people had lost sight of what it was actually for. And so what we see Jesus reacting to are people who have figured out the actions that they need to do, at least at a minimum, but nothing else. We see it in other places where Jesus talks about the Pharisees as people who tithe everything, even down to their very spices, but have forgotten the purpose of tithing, who have lost sight of the holiness, the sacredness of the temple, for example. And they would swear by the gold on the temple, but not the temple itself, losing sight of the fact that the gold was just gold. Its only connection to the sacred was where it was. And so what Jesus is doing in this section of Matthew is he's helping people look at the law for what it's trying to accomplish. And he's doing that by expanding what the law actually is. And he begins with the obvious one. You've heard it said that people long ago do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment, which of course is the case. But Jesus expands that and says the issue isn't just killing people. It isn't that killing people is a thing in and of itself in isolation, and that thing is wrong. Killing people is misusing people. It's taking advantage of God's creation in the form of people and doing whatever we want with them, and that's what's wrong. And he says it's more than that. If you're angry with people, it's just as bad. He goes on to say all these other things about offerings and about going to court with people. He talks about adultery and divorce and oaths and all of these things. And what he does in each of them is he says, this is what you've been told. And he identifies the discrete action. And he says, that's not enough. And where this all comes from is when we go back to where we read last week. And if we go back to Matthew 5, verse 17, in this translation, Jesus says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And these are the examples of what it means to fulfill those the law and the prophets. What Jesus is telling us is that the law in the Old Testament wasn't given to us as a list of boxes for us to check, although it appears that way. The law was given to create a framework in which people might understand that God has demands upon us that limit our behavior. And that's where it begins. But that's not where it ends. The law was never intended as just a checkbox of simple actions that you could do or not do. I mean, look at the Ten Commandments. Everybody goes, well, the Ten Commandments are pretty easy. It's a bunch of checkboxes. Until you get to 10, which is all about how you think, about what you do with other people, more than just actions, more than just killing them or not killing them, committing adultery or not committing adultery. It's don't even envy people. Don't even covet things, which is an internal thing. And we already see, like, that's an obvious looking towards this larger expansion of what the law means and simply doing or not doing a thing. The law, in some ways, was easier than what Jesus is asking here. Because if you look at the law as just checkboxes, that is quite easy. I mean, there's a lot of them. There's a lot to remember. I mean, it'd be hard for all of us, I think, to commit all of them to memory. But when you think about it, if you look at laws as simply either or, simple binaries, did you kill somebody? Did you not kill somebody? Did you commit adultery? Did you not commit adultery? Those are, in a sense, they're easy to do because they're either or. But what do you do about something like being angry with somebody? Is that an either or? Well, maybe, but it's much more complicated than that. What's the difference between being sinfully angry with one of your siblings? And I had many opportunities to do that, as well as I think anybody who had siblings did, unless you were gifted with perfect siblings, in which case, well, I don't think I want to hear about it because I might just become jealous. But what's the difference between being sinfully angry with your siblings and being angry with what they've done because it's harmful to someone else and you want to make them better? It's a continuum now. It's not as simple as it was before. I never killed any of my brothers. Not saying I didn't cross my mind and maybe even tried in my own small little way. That's easy. But was I ever angry with them in ways that were destructive? Yes. I know that for sure. Was I ever angry with them in ways that weren't destructive? Well, I think so too. But then there's a whole bunch of them in between that I'm not quite sure where they were. Jesus is calling us to something that is harder, but also better. Because isn't it better to deal with the anger that might eventually cause you to seriously injure someone before you get to that point? Isn't it helpful for us to realize that our internal world often turns into our external actions? Isn't it much better for us to realize that lust can move us to bad decisions that are incredibly destructive to us and our families and someone else's family and all of those things? Doesn't that help us pay attention to our internal thoughts? Doesn't it help us pay attention to the difference between appreciating the beauty of another human being, which is a good thing, and morphing it into something more selfish. If we're not pushed to think in these terms, if all we're thinking of is simple outcomes, it's much too easy, I think, for us to think that what we're considering or what we're fantasizing about or what's going through our mind doesn't matter, but it does. And Jesus is telling us over and over again in this passage and in other places that what we think matters, that the law isn't enough, and it never was enough. The law didn't change people's internal selves as frequently as we would perhaps want it to. Instead, the law created a group of people who had a perfect grasp on the checkboxes, but no practical understanding of why they were checking one box or the other. And Jesus is saying, no, this kind of thing matters. Instead of just waiting until we're about to murder somebody, take a step back and pay attention to when you're angry. Take a step back in all of these things and realize that we begin the process that perhaps ends us with being on the wrong side of the checklist. And the things that move us towards being on that wrong side are just as bad, because without them, the other doesn't come. I mean, this is strong language that Jesus uses here. We can't just sort of gloss over this part. This isn't the same kind of hyperbole that we sometimes see Jesus exercising. Jesus is saying very clearly, these things are as important as the outcomes that we see identified in the law. Being angry with someone can be just as bad as killing them. Looking at someone with lust in your heart can be just as destructive to you and your relationships as actually committing adultery. Being someone who has to be pinned down to take a formal oath rather than being trustworthy in what you say. Well, if you can't be trusted in just what you say, what difference does an oath make, really? You'll find some way to wiggle around it, I'm sure. Jesus looked at this rich tradition that his people had, and it's a rich tradition. And he said, it's not enough. It has moved you in directions that haven't been as helpful as you thought they would be, and it's not accomplishing what God actually wanted it to do. But it moved the Jewish people and all of us to the stage where Jesus could then come and say, this is what God was getting at. The law isn't enough, but we can't just ignore it. We look at it and see where it goes and where it's taken us today. And that's what we're looking at on a Heritage Sunday. Let's look back at the heritage that we do have as Presbyterians, as Christians, as the individual families we're in. But let's not get so caught up on it that we say it's all an either or. It was all good or it was all bad or anything of that nature. But let's look at the foundation that we have, the heritage we have, as a place for us to begin looking at what we can do next. In the same way that Jesus didn't come to abolish the law, we're not being asked to forget where we came from. We're asked to look at some of the things as Presbyterians that we did in the past that we're not proud of, and to do what we can to make them better. By officially repudiating the doctrine of discovery, we're saying that that was all done by a mistake, that it was a misunderstanding of God's purposes for the world. We don't just pretend it never happened. Our heritage has shaped us into who we are today, and we need to honor the past without letting us be shackled by it and not turning it into a law. In the same way that Jesus took the law that was there and said, this is where it was taking us. Let's look at the heritage that we have as the people of faith that we are and see where it can take us now to new and better places, not ignoring the past, but taking the best from the past and applying it to who we are today. Oh, man.